Dr. William Luther Pierce, the year 2000. Returning Fire.
Hello. The question on the mind of every patriot, of every concerned American, is what should we do to oppose most effectively the enemies of our people? By what methods should we fight the media bosses, the politicians, the liberals, and the others who are destroying our society, our civilization, and our race? I was on a Christian radio talk show a few days ago, and the consensus seemed to be that we should read our Bibles and pray. I really don't believe that's going to get the job done. When I talk with conservatives, most of what I hear is about voting, about electing the right politicians to the Congress and the White House. Some of them favor the Republicans, and some favor a third party. And I should tell you that I have about as much confidence in that approach as I do in praying. If we had a proportional representation system in this country, like they have in many European countries, so that we might hope to elect just a few responsible people to the Congress and have a voice there, then I suppose I would have just a little more patience with conservatives. But as long as we're stuck with the two-party shell game in this country, voting will no more get the job done than praying. When I talk with some of my young radical friends, especially those of the skinhead persuasion, they're inclined toward bombing, burning, slaying, and pillaging. They would like to lay waste to this whole evil thing that our society has become today. Some of their music certainly reflects that attitude, and I'm inclined to believe that their music is a frank expression of what they're feeling. And really, when I examine my own feelings, they're the same. This society calls out to be destroyed as much as Sodom or Gomorrah ever did. Whenever I see that smiling, lying piece of filth we have in the White House come on my television screen and remind us all that he's still there, still president, still commander-in-chief of our armed forces, and worse than that, still accepted by most Americans as their president, then I must ask myself how reasonable men can believe that the same system which put Bill Clinton into the White House, that the same system which got us into this cesspool, can get us out again. I mean, approximately half of the electorate seems to be enthusiastic about having as their next president a man who has been a faithful helper of the current piece of filth. And as for the Republicans, all I really see is a difference in degree, not in kind. The Republicans appeal to a slightly more successful stratum of the population, a slightly more sophisticated stratum, and so they themselves are obliged to be slightly less obvious in their crookedness and treason. But really, are there 10 righteous men in the whole rotten system to justify trying to preserve it? I think not. I had to visit New York City on Wednesday and Thursday of this week to do a Mike Wallace interview for 60 Minutes. And God, you know, I felt just like John Rocker did when he surveyed Times Square. Zoo City. The New York Jews call it diversity, and they love it. I call it ugliness and degeneracy incarnate, and I hate it. My gut feeling was that the whole city ought to be leveled to the ground and then plowed with salt. When I see one of the women of my people, a white woman, walking along a New York sidewalk, arm in arm with some dusky denizen of the African jungle, because she has been talked that fashion by the New York lords of the television screen, I feel a rage inside myself that is difficult to suppress. Why should I not be able to do what is right and natural and kill those who commit such an abomination, as well as those who teach them to commit such abominations. I feel it my duty as an upright man of my race to do everything in my power to stamp out those who defile my people. I feel it my duty to set an example for others. And it makes me feel sick when I must suppress this rage. But you know, that is what I ask the young people to do when they listen to their fighting music. I tell them that they need self-discipline, that it is fine to listen to people singing about slaughtering the enemies of our people, because it helps to build consciousness and determination. But they must control their rage and not let it become self-destructive. They must not turn to vandalism or hooliganism or mindless drunken brawling and end up in prison. But instead they must harden themselves and train themselves for the time when their rage can be used constructively. So, what about the rest of us? What should we be doing now? In trying to answer that question, we must be constantly aware of the truly bizarre situation we're in today. It's surreal. A war of annihilation is being waged against us. It's taking a terrible toll, doing enormous damage to us. And yet most of us go about our daily business as if nothing unusual were happening. Our cities are being invaded and taken over. Our suburbs are being invaded. Our schools have been made into jungles. Here are a few statistics which you can check for yourself in almost any good almanac. In 1950, 90% of the population of the United States was white. Most of the other 10% was black, and they kept to themselves. We didn't have to look at them. Today, whites are down to just over 70%. It's actually much worse than that, since the total population of the country has nearly doubled during the past 50 years, up from 151 million in 1950 to more than 280 million today, including illegal aliens. That means that we have more than five times as many non-whites in the country as we had 50 years ago, and three times as many non-whites relative to our own numbers. Furthermore, we're having them all rubbed in our faces. They don't keep to themselves in their part of town, in their schools, like they used to. We certainly notice these things, even though they have taken place over a period of several decades. They affect our daily lives. And you know, this invasion of our living space by non-white minorities isn't something which just happened like global warming. It has been engineered by those whose aim is to wipe out our people, to destroy our race. Our enemies are so close to their goal now, and so certain that they will achieve it, that they are boasting openly that within the next few decades, they will have the white race in America reduced to minority status. Then they can finish us off by means of the democratic process. Bill Clinton has made this boast a number of times during the past few years when speaking to Jewish or liberal audiences, and he always gets a lot of applause. Some of those who applaud are just being trendy, just going along with the fashion of hating white people and worshiping the idea of equality and multiculturalism. But others are active duty members of the enemy army. What these enemies are doing to us is as much a hostile action as if they were firing artillery projectiles across our borders and dropping bombs on our cities. We should be actively defending ourselves. We should be shooting back. We should be going from door to door with a list of names and slaying those who have engineered this assault on our people. And really, it is an engineered assault. The change in our immigration laws to bring in millions of non-whites from around the world while cutting off the immigration of whites from Europe The refusal to round up and deport illegal immigrants except on a token scale. The forced integration of whites with non-whites in schools, neighborhoods, and workplaces. The encouragement of miscegenation by the controlled mass media. Those things are all deliberate. They all have been planned. And we know who the engineers are. They have not engineered this war against our people without revealing their hands. They are, first and foremost, the media bosses and the other leaders of the Jews. The Jews were the prime movers behind the changes in our immigration laws. They were the most powerful backers of all of the so-called civil rights laws which have destroyed our schools and neighborhoods. And most important, they are the producers and disseminators of the poisonous propaganda of equality and racial mixing coming from Hollywood and New York, which keeps our people softened up and unresisting. And the Jews have picked up an army of Gentile camp followers, politicians, preachers and church leaders, feminists and homosexuals, members of the liberal educational establishment. The politicians are simply amoral opportunists who will dance to whatever tune is being played by the controlled media at the moment. And that's all that any of them are, at least in the political mainstream. Whenever one who isn't simply an amoral opportunist shows up on the sidelines and tries to participate, he gets the Pat Buchanan and Jörg Haider treatment. The preachers and church leaders see an advantage for themselves in a dumbed-down population, a more credulous and superstitious population, and they are just about as opportunistic as the politicians. Christian leadership really has gone downhill fast during the past few centuries, and especially during the 20th century. Bob Jones University used to prohibit miscegenation, and that really was its one claim to righteousness. But look how quickly it caved in and abandoned that claim a couple of weeks ago just to avoid media criticism. Compare that spineless and opportunistic behavior with the principled stand made by Martin Luther 480 years earlier. He was ready and willing to be burned at the stake over a far less fundamental doctrinal matter. The feminists and the homosexuals have turned against their own people and become partisans of the Jews because they see that as the better chance for hanging on to the unnatural advantages they now have. They're afraid that if white men ever regain control of the situation, they'll be forced to go back into the kitchen, or the closet, as the case may be. And as for the liberals, many of them are simply opportunists like the politicians. They are ideological chameleons without any real morality, without souls. They are for whatever is politically correct at the moment and against whatever is not. It is political correctness itself which is important to them rather than any specific doctrine. As for the rest of the liberals, the ones who really believe the lunatic doctrines of equality and diversity and multiculturalism which they endorse, they're simply crazy and ought to be put down like the sick puppies they are. Anyway, that's the situation with which we're faced. It's a more dangerous situation, a more threatening situation than any we have faced in the past, including invasions by Moors and Mongols and Turks. We knew how to fight back against those other invaders, and we did. You saw a Turk, you either killed him or he killed you. There are three big differences between our earlier wars for survival and the war we're engaged in today. First, the earlier wars had an element of suddenness in them, which is lacking in today's war. When a band of Mongol horsemen suddenly appeared on the horizon, and you could see the smoke of burning villages behind them, You didn't go back to your ball game or wait around to see what would happen next. Second, the degree of treason among our people is vastly higher than it ever has been before. When the Moors invaded the Iberian Peninsula in the 8th century, the people who secretly opened the city gates to them were Jews, but our own people were solidly united against the enemy. When the Mongols invaded Russia, and when the Turks were laying siege to Constantinople, there probably were a few traitors among our people who were working secretly for the enemy, but the number certainly was very small. Today, our whole society is riddled with traitors from top to bottom. In particular, the entire political power structure and much of the rest, the leadership of our society, is in the enemy camp. Kill an enemy soldier, and your own police will grab you and lock you up. As I said, it's a bizarre sort of war. The third big difference is the role of the mass media. This is the first real race war in which we've been involved, in which there have been any mass media, and they are nearly all in the hands of the enemy. The enemy uses the mass media in two ways. He uses them to control the outcome of the democratic political process. It is through his media that the candidates and issues are presented to the public. Thus, the politicians automatically fall into his pocket. And he uses the media to confuse the public and paralyze its will to resist. Everything which happens in the world is shown to the public through the distorting lens of television. The Jewish media bosses are able to put their spin on every issue and on the explanation of every development or event. If the Jews decide that we need to starve another million Iraqi children to death with our blockade of Iraq so that that country will not be able to pose any threat to Israel in the future, Michael Eisner's ABC television news programs will explain why the maintenance of the blockade is necessary for the comfort and security of couch potatoes all over America. If the Serbs persist in their determination to reclaim their sovereign territory now occupied by Madeleine Albright's NATO soldiers, if the Serbs continue to complain that those soldiers are protecting the KLA murder squads, which are ethnically cleansing Serbia's Kosovo province of its remaining Serbs, then Sumner Redstone can have his CBS television commentators explain why another humanitarian bombing of Belgrade is the right thing for our government to undertake. That will be enough to keep the couch potatoes placidly watching their ball games. The media, unfortunately, are engaged in activities which are much more destructive than just keeping the public confused about what's happening, however. They take a proactive role in destroying the will of the public to resist, in persuading large segments of the public to cross over to their side. They subvert some, and they intimidate others. It is the Jewish media which have persuaded white children by the millions to imitate the dress, speech, and manners of blacks, and to listen to the morally and culturally destructive music of blacks, even to chant anti-white ditties along with their favorite black rap artists, and which also have conditioned white adults to spend hundreds of hours every year cheering the antics of black basketball players, to regard the more skillful black ball players as celebrities, as heroes, as role models. The mass media of news and entertainment in the hands of the Jews gives them a bigger military advantage over us than 1,000 armored divisions on the ground and a fleet of 10,000 B-2 bombers in the air fully loaded with nuclear bombs. A formidable force indeed. Now, because the media are the enemy's most powerful weapon, I have taken the simple-minded approach of trying to fight back by building our own media. I don't know that what I'm doing will be enough. But I do know that without a voice which can reach all of our people, inform all of our people, and inspire some of our people, we are lost. If the voices of the enemy are the only voices our people hear, then we are lost. One can see the proof of this in a thousand ways. Consider just the immigration problem, for example. Mexican immigrants are imported by the thousands into a formerly white area to work in a poultry plant or to do farm labor. The local white people become upset when their taxes go up, their schools begin filling up with young Mexicans, and their women aren't safe on the streets any longer. At this point, the politicians and the preachers and the social workers begin assuring the people that having the Mexicans in their area is all for the better, that it will help the economy, that it will add diversity to their schools, and more diversity is always a wonderful thing, that we are a nation of immigrants, and there always are a few little problems of readjustment when a new wave of immigrants arrives, and so we should just be more patient and more tolerant, etc. And besides, it's inevitable. There's nothing you can do about it. And if you don't like it, you're a racist or a hate criminal. This is the message in all of the enemy media, in the newspapers, on the radio, on local television. And when that's all the people hear, they become discouraged. They don't fight back. They don't start shooting politicians and preachers and breaking the necks of social workers and running the Mexicans back toward the border, because they know that the enemy's police and troops would arrive to protect the Mexicans and arrest the Americans. So they give up and resign themselves to the enemy takeover of their communities, their schools, their economy. That's the way it is in most places in America today. But in a few places, we are beginning to have our own voice. In a few places, my organization, the National Alliance, has been able to contradict the enemy. When a white community in North Carolina was overwhelmed by Mexicans, we were able to organize public protests and let the people know that they don't have to resign themselves to the invasion, that they can fight back. When Bill Clinton's friend and supporter, Donald Tyson, brought tens of thousands of Mexicans into white areas of Arkansas to work in his Tyson Foods poultry plants, we were able to put up enough stickers and distribute enough leaflets at least to let the local people hear an opposing voice, to let there is another view besides that of the politicians and preachers and social workers. What we are able to do now, in countering the massive firepower of the enemy's media, isn't much, of course. It's like using a BB gun to return the fire of a missile cruiser. But our voice is growing louder and reaching more people. 3 or 4 months from now, it perhaps will be equivalent to a .22 caliber rifle. And one of these days, we'll blast that missile cruiser right out of the water. Meanwhile, it wouldn't be a bad thing for a lot of other people to get out their BB guns and help us return fire. Thanks for being with me again today.